Empire Fixes. Release to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5. Clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altimeter 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff. Clear for the airspace. Fire projector.
Viper 01, be advised, the restrictor 6002 is still active.
Turn in, lights on.
Next, picture 610, 15,000, target is in the
back. Viper 1 targeted.
What's up, and thanks for listening in. This is a bonus episode. We're going to talk about the Super Bowl. Specifically, we're going to talk with Steve Hinton, who is leading the flyover for the Super Bowl. He'll be leading the charge in a P-51. And Lieutenant Colonel Chris McLear, Nike, good friend of mine, who will be part of the ground party. He's the guy that, along with a team, works with the NFL, CBS, and then relaying to the formation all the changes, all the stuff that is going on to try and enable the formation to be over the stadium at home of the Brave. So we're talking to both of them today. Before we get rolling, just a couple quick admin notes. As always, thank you for everyone who's taking the time to drop over to iTunes and leave a rating or review. That helps the podcast out. Thank you, as always, to my Patreon supporters for helping the podcast grow. If you're looking for some additional content, you can swing over to theafterburnpodcast.com. There's links to Patreon as well as some videos and things of that nature. And if you're a person who happens to like swag such as stickers and coffee mugs, you can shop Afterburn Podcast gear over at theafterburnpodcast.com. And finally, before we get rolling in, we're going to talk about Beyond Blue logbooks. I've done advertising before on the podcast. It's one of those things I tend to shy away from. I really want to make sure it's a good fit for the podcast, for you that are listening, and you know, the company that wants to do the advertising. Not everything always meshes well. Some companies that I'm a big proponent for: Wingman Watches, great company. B-Jet Clean is another veteran fighter pilot-owned company that makes soap. They donate proceeds to various foundations, one of which being Pyro's Wings, which, and we obviously did an episode on Pyro. But today I'm going to talk about Beyond Blue logbooks a little bit in depth. If you're a pilot, you want to listen to this. If you're not a pilot, you probably can skip ahead for the next 45 to 60 seconds and jump into the episode. But if you're a pilot, so I use Beyond Blue logbooks when I transitioned out of the military, because if you're in the military, you realize your flight records are probably a hot mess. Mine were. I just didn't keep a logbook. I relied on the Air Force to do that. But Beyond Blue logbooks, it's a comprehensive logbook solution for all types of pilots, both military and civilian. Civilians, if you got a mix of handwritten and digital logbooks stashed away somewhere, Beyond Blue, they can consolidate, organize them, and get you ready for your next interview or application. They'll transcribe them, they're accurate, and they're updated throughout your career. It's a great service. Again, I used them, very happy. Military guys, civilian guys, again, when you're applying to other jobs and other airlines, everyone wants something different. You might not have tracked your night sorties, your cross-country time, or your landings. Beyond Blue logbooks can fix that and solve that problem for you. It's a veteran-owned company. They get it. They know what the airlines are looking for. They know what aviation companies are looking for. They can square away all your stuff. They're a great team, great company. It worked out for me. Very happy with the product they put out. And if you use the code SENDIT before March 1st, you'll get 10% off your order. Again, you don't have to be ready right now to go to the next phase or next job. And in fact, the time to do it is now. Let Beyond Blue keep your logbooks updated. Let them clean up the mess now so that when the time comes, you're not scrambling and you don't even have to worry about it. So again, swing over to Beyond Blue logbooks. Check them out. Again, highly recommend it. You won't be disappointed. All right, with that said, let's jump into the episode with Steve and Nike. I think I'm still thawing out from that experience.
Yeah, me too. And when I switched to pencils, although I got pens now because my pencil went bad, but I switched to pencils after that. I told you that story. So.
Yeah, I mean... this should be a little bit better. I mean, it's like a record high out there this week, isn't it?
It's nice. It's really nice. Yeah. I'm waiting for the big wind and all the dirt to blow, but yeah. This time of year, it can happen right away.
What's the weather supposed to be like for Sunday? Is it supposed to be good?
It's supposed to be in the even close to 80 even, but there's a chance of some clouds coming in too, but you know, we'll figure it out.
God, well, I mean, it's Southern California, right? It's supposed to be always sunny or high skies. Although when I did Chino, I remember the fog bank, it rolls in there.
Yep. Marine layer, they call that. Yeah, just the clouds in the morning.
Things we don't have to worry about in Georgia. So, you know.
There you are.
Awesome. Steve, thanks for joining me on the podcast. I have mentioned your name before, whether you know it or not, but you are the guy who has forgotten more about aviation than I'll ever know. So I'm super humbled to have you on here today and just talk and share about your experience with not only aviation, but we're going to talk about the Super Bowl, Heritage Flight. This is a big year for you. So excited to have you on here. So thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the invite.
So with that, you are the man who is leading the flyover this Sunday for the Super Bowl. A little bit of pressure.
No pressure. That's what they told me. So, but no, I understand that. And of course you and I were, you know, part of that a few years ago too. And, you know, you just do your job and it is what it is. You know, I think we brief real good. We practice, you know, we'll do our best. This is a complicated scenario though, as far as I'm concerned, way more complicated than we had in Minneapolis.
What makes it more complicated than Minneapolis?
Well, remember Minneapolis, we practiced, a couple of days before, and we were also within line of sight of the stadium, and we were able to ad lib as we go. But we're going to be called out of the hold over that Point Doom there in Malibu, and we have a track to fly. So, you know, in your F-16, when you do flybys, you know, you get a little behind, you could dial up another 100 knots or something. But we're going to be stuck. We're going to be stuck. You know, there isn't a lot of speed to play with. So, we're going to have to be creative when we brief here tomorrow morning of how, you know, we can, you know, I tell the story too. Well, you know, that morning in Minneapolis, when we met with the NFL and ABC and FAA and Sports Center and everybody there. And they said, we got to be over the stadium at 15, 20 and 50 seconds. I just kind of chuckled. And then the guy looked at me, says, no, we're serious. You're serious to the second? He goes, as close as you can make it. So, you know, better pay more attention here. But that's kind of what this is. You know, we're on the national stage, the international stage, you know, and we're representing more than just, you know, we're representing the Air Force. So this is a lot of pressure on us to make sure we can pull this off. But I'm confident we'll be able to do a good job. You bet.
Well, you nailed it in Minneapolis. And I was talking to Nike about this. I think it's very easy, especially in a modern fighter, relatively speaking, to be where you need to be when you need to be there, right? The jet is telling you that information. And obviously there's variables that can pop up that hinder that, but you know, you're flying a P-51. You don't have a heads up display. You don't have the ability to type in a waypoint, then spit out an airspeed to fly or an airspeed carrot that's telling you speed up or slow down. Like, I wasn't having to work that hard. You're having to work. The only other experience I have with a really challenging Heritage Flight flyover was with McKenna up in New York, where we had a 25-mile run-in, which is, it was very challenging because the radios didn't work that far out. So you're pushing, you can't maneuver left or right, you can't do a 360. But can you kind of talk to, like, can you make any big time adjustments? What's like your max plus or minus once you turn in and are flying towards the stadium?
You know, I don't have any numbers to speak of, for instance, but like in Minneapolis, remember, we came out of the hold and we didn't go right to the stadium because we were just a little bit ahead. So we took a little angle, and then I had street map dialed up on my iPhone for the stadium there, and it was giving me time to station. And so I just kind of, you know, played that turn a little bit, and we just ate up a few more seconds and it worked out. But this route, I don't know if you've seen it, you know, it's got us flying from the hold to another hold position over Santa Monica, then a 90-degree turn. Oh, but it's a corridor we're supposed to stay in. So hopefully we'll have enough room to maybe cut a corner or extend a turn, maybe. You know, I'm not sure. But I'm going to be blaming it all on Bull, because I'm going to rely on him, because he's got all that cool stuff in there.
Yeah.
Along with my street map, you know, maybe we'll pull it off.
just being creative. That's what it takes when it comes down to this stuff, which is, you know, it's amazing when you're talking
about
this.
Isn't that what we're trained to do, though? Isn't that what we do as an American? You know, you got to think on your feet. You got to figure out how to get it done.
Make it happen. That is the name of the game. Let's talk a little bit about, you're flying Wee Willie this weekend, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about Wee Willie, the history with that plane specifically?
Well, I'll tell you what, Wee Willie is a combo airplane. It was part of we put it together from a lot of crash bits, including, you know, the Red Baron racer that I crashed in Reno back in 1979. But it was built as a fighter, and all the parts really are, one wing is off of one crash, another wing's off another crash. And it's pretty much a composite airplane, but the heart of it is that 7715 Charlie, which started life after the military, a civilian airplane up in Seattle, and participated in the Reno Air Races, and it was won the Reno races three times. But 1979, I had an engine failure, couldn't make the runway, and ended up landing short in a explosion, and airplane was really little bits and pieces, but that's the heart and soul of that airplane. The same people that, as our race crew, you know, we're the same guys at Chino, and we put it all together, and it flies great. We're really lucky. We rebuilt it, first flew it in 84, and it's been flying ever since. I think the last time I counted, we had 28 different people have flown it. So it's been very reliable, and it's a fast Mustang. It's one of those, you talk to guys who fly a lot of different Mustangs, and you know, they're all a little different. And this one just feels like a very comfortable machine when you're flying it. So I'm real happy with it.
Well, it's incredible to see for the listeners. I mean, to me, it's amazing that these planes are still flying, but you do a lot of rebuilding. As mentioned, you rebuilt Wee Willie. That is your job, rebuilding airplanes. But it's not uncommon to see you hopping out at F-86 and then hopping into a P-38 and then hopping into a P-51. Can you talk to me a little bit about flying those different airplanes and how do you manage it? I'm just simple-minded. Like I can only do one thing, but you're doing so many different things and you're spanning different eras of airplanes. A little bit of experience.
Oh, well, that's really it. And, you know, I've had the fortunate, just the fortune of opportunities. And, you know, I first flew a Mustang when I was 20, 19 or 20. And then it was like a Hellcat. Of course, we flew a T6 and all the trainers and every Cessna. You know, we used to wash airplanes at the airport. Every Cessna Piper we get our hands on. And something, there was a Twin Beach there. We got to fly once in a while. But it's just experience. And I, maybe the biggest thing to me is important to understand how systems work, how airplanes work. And you can relate to, anybody can relate to that. Your comfort level goes way up when you know what a switch does or how a hydraulic system works. You know, flying's pretty easy, as you know. I mean, you know, you get the right. I was really lucky as a young man to have an Air Force guy really kind of kept track of us. You know, a lot of people I've seen, you know, they'll get checked on a plane and they're off on their own, and sometimes they get in trouble, sometimes they don't. But we had some good supervision for a lot of years, and that really, I think, helped. And, you know, we had good training and a lot of luck too. So
what got you into the restoration of these warbirds?
Well, I'm a hands-on guy, you know. As a teenager, I for one thing, I've been around Planes at Fame Museum since I was seven, believe it or not. And you know, as a young man, you're inspired by mechanical things. I mean, first vehicle I drove was the airport tug, you know, a forklift, and you just kind of go from there, you know. You know, to me, it's not rocket science. Let's put it that way. So, I have flown airplanes that require a lot of training. Like first time I flew an F-5, by the way, I got checked down an F-5 flew for 20-25 hours. That was pretty unique airplane. Yeah. I'd flown the F-86 and the T-33 and a NAT, and it still was a different animal. And it took a couple flights before I felt comfortable in that thing. But, you know, every airplane's a little different, but they're all kind of the same too. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that is true. Inherently, up is good, down is bad. Usually, you know, trees sure. Big, you know, but there's a lot,
you know,
to it.
And rain, another thing to consider, you know, is that my mission is not a complicated mission with the airplane. You know, when you get checked on a plane, it's not about just taking off and landing and flying formation air shows. I mean, you're doing a mission, you know, and I can relate to that. And that's, you know, that's what the complexity of being efficient and doing what you're supposed to do. But physically taking off and landing, guy, you can do that with your eyes closed.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the F-16 was designed to be an easy plane to fly. And I mean, most planes now, that's what it's designed to do, be easy to fly. Modern fighters, easy to fly, so you can focus on the missionized piece of it, of employing the weapons and doing that thing. But there's still something about, at least the knowledge of the systems and things like that that go into all the different planes you fly, that's really impressive. So I know you're not underselling
it. Thanks.
It's
yeah, thanks. Thanks for the compliment, but I'm not the only one. I have a lot of my friends are just awesome. You know, they do a lot of stuff, the same things I do, and I've just had a lot of great opportunities.
Yeah. Well, right time, right place. That's a lot of life,
exactly.
You know, but
being available and first one to the phone sometimes it rings, you know.
That's awesome.
That's why I got in the movie business. The phone rang at the shop, and my buddy's right next to me, but I grabbed the phone, and it was a job to work on that Baba Black Sheep TV show. If he grabbed the phone, then he would have got the job probably. But that's how it kind of works. Yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. And then, you know, you happen to be living there in SoCal. So, I mean, it is convenient for this flyover. But also you're kind of wrapping up your time with the Air Force Heritage Flight Foundation, as I hear.
Yes. Yeah. I've been operating under waivers for the last 5 years, you know, this year it was just time to move on. So, believe me, it was a very exciting part. It's always great to have a mission and, flying with some of the greatest pilots I've ever met in my life. You know, you're included in that list, by the way. And, it's always been exciting, you know, being part of the air show and the training scenarios we do. It's been a real honor, but everything comes to an end, and I'm satisfied where we are. Just, you know, our goal is to pull this one off, and I'm not going off in the sunset, though. I mean, I'm not done. I'm still lots going on in my life.
Yeah, well, I mean, are you still the president of Planes of Fame, right?
Right, exactly.
You got the restoration business going on. I'm sure you're still doing movies. Yeah. You got a lot.
Yeah, we did a lot of that, and of course, my son is going to replace me, so to speak. So they didn't even have to change any of the print on the flyers because he's Steve Hinton. But he's tell you what, he's the 2.0 version. I mean, you know about Steve-O's racing career, and he's a very smart, talented guy. Of course, he's my boy. I'll brag about him, but he is, you know, he really is conscious and smart, and he'll carry on and improve things as we go. So, I mean, he's also a dad now, so he's going to get that part of it. You know, that'll wise him up a little bit. So, yeah.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. So you were the youngest person to win Reno. Then Steve-O, son, beat you.
Yeah, I was 26 when I won, and Steve was 22.
Yeah, so, I mean, he smoked you.
Yeah, well, when I won, we won Reno, and then we went and did one Mojave twice because it had him. In 1 year period, I had two races. I won the Miami air races. And then we set the world speed record all in 1 year.
Gosh.
So that 1 year, and I got hired by Western Airlines in the middle of that too. And that was, a fabulous year. Steve, when he won five races in a row every year for five in a row and lost another one, won another one, and then lost another one. So his record is, he's tied for the most winning unlimited racer at Reno. You know, he has the qualifying lap speed, 499 miles an hour.
Wow.
So, you know, back in my day, we were 440s kind of.
Yeah.
It's a little different race course. You know, it's like anything. You can't judge modern times, you know, racing cars or whatever versus old times. Even though it is more advanced, it's still, you know, it's a different race course and all, but no, he's done really well. Really proud of him.
It's incredible. Well, having been out in Reno and been underneath the pylon, if people haven't done that, that's an incredible experience. I mean, the planes are moving. To say the least.
Yeah. Yep. And you know, it's fun too, through the years, you know, to meet Hoot Gibson and Skip Holm and some of the other military guys that have done all this stuff in their first year there, they're just kind of going, whatever, you know, this is cool. But then, you know, it makes the hair stand up on the back of their head too. You know, they have been like Coot Gibson, you know what I mean? You know, he's flown the shuttle several times, but when he out there bending the throttle on a Sea Fury and the engine blows up and he's got to figure out how to land the thing without hurting himself. And, you know, that's a different type of excitement, but it's every bit as yeah. critical as anything he's ever done, you know?
Well, I mean, when you're at 50 feet going 400 plus miles an hour and your engine explodes, there's not a lot of great options, you know, at that point. So it can be exciting.
Yeah, you know, exactly. But whatever.
Can you talk to me the difference between restoring like Wee Willie, which would say, you know, right now I'm not a race plane, right? But what is the difference? What goes into building one of these planes that competes, you know, in the limited class at Reno?
Well, a lot. You know, like if you took Wee Willie right now, let's say a stock airplane and made it like Voodoo, like Stevo races, you know, it's reduce the size of the wingspan, reduce it by about 6 feet in total length, put a small cockpit in it. You know, you reduce any kind of drag you can. You put a smaller scoop on it. You put wing fillets on it, you know, where it meets the fuselage. And in Voodoo's case, you know, they actually adjusted the fuselage on the wing because at 400 knots, the wing has an X angle of attack, you know, and to make the airplane as small as it can. So they adjust that. Then they have to change the tail angle. And really unique thing Voodoo has that nobody's done is thanks to a gentleman, Joe Clark, his company, Aviation Partners, they laser mapped the airfoil of the Mustang and confirmed that in certain parts of the wing at about 0.72 Mach, that's where the shockwave grows. And so what they did is they on Voodoo made a modification to the shape of the wing in that area by adding a composite. Actually, it's about this tall, if you could imagine, and the trailing edge of the wing right before it meets the flap. And that in the computer model brought it up to 0.8 before the shock wave or the drag is by the shock wave happens. So, for instance, when Steve set the world speed record with that airplane, his first run when everything was running good was 554 miles an hour. I know. I was in the T-33 with a camera on it, and I'm doing about 320, 340 knots kind of thing. And he'd shoot by me like a, you know, just like you would when you're going that fast. Yeah. But, you know, and also it comes after while you're modifying things or whatever, and you do the flight testing, and it turns a totally different kind of airplane. You know, it's hard to see out of. You also have chemicals in the airplane. You know, you have water injection on the engine and your spray bar across the radiator. And different, the way the airplane flies, they're not really great flying airplanes at all. They're big and heavy until you're going really fast. Where they, you know, when you get them up about 400 knots is where they kind of trim out. But, you know, 90%, I would say, well, 80% of it really is the horsepower the engine can put out. And that Merlin is built to run at 1,490 horsepower is what that -7 Merlin would run.
That's incredible.
The hybrid Merlin that's in Voodoo and Strega and, you know, any of those, you know, they're like 3,400 horsepower.
Wow.
And it is, yeah. And of course, it's a hand grenade you pull a pin out of. You don't know how long it's going to last, but there's been some spectacular explosions out there, you know, and burn pistons or throw a rod out the side. But, yeah, it's the chances you take. You know, we built an airplane. I was part of the crew that finished the airplane called Tsunami back in the 80s. But that was a special build airplane. And I did all the flights on that. That was the first plane I'd ever flown that had never flown or the design had never flown. And that was a real handful of an airplane and high wing loading. It was looked like a miniature Mustang, but it had a Merlin engine on it. And we never won the Reno races with it. We did win a race in Sherman, Texas with it. And we did beat Strega. So that kind of was pretty cool. But it was really interesting to, you know, work on that, build that thing and do all the flights on it and race it at Reno for 4 years. So
Steve, anytime you describe an engine as a hand grenade that you just pulled the pin in, I don't know if it's something I want to fly.
Well, you know, that there's something to that, and it's not for everybody. Believe me, it's, you know, you fly high performance jets, and, you know, but you've got a red line and a max power, and the throttle hits a stop, and the computer says, that's it. Well, this is like, you know, to pull a circuit breaker on the computer and push it a little more and find out what breaks, and push it a little more, find out what breaks, fix it. You know, you're doing that with that and run. And finally, I mean, we're at a stage now where it's just running as much as that supercharger will put out. You know, the engine's designed to run at 61 inches, which is 30 pounds of boost. And now we're running 145 inches, you know, and that's 45, 50 pounds of boost, 50, 60 pounds of boost is what that is. Yeah. Yeah, that's big time, you know, and the fuel is special, and we're injecting water alcohol in the engines to keep the temperatures down for detonation control. You know, the whole thing is that the rods are different, you know, the pistons are all different.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Quite a hybrid, yeah.
Yeah, and, to say the least. And, those motors, they last about, I mean, one race weekend. Is that kind of the plan?
Well, even when they don't blow up, that's kind of what you think. For instance, you know, being involved with the guys who rebuild the engines too, you know, they start out with a good engine and you put a few hours on it to make sure it's running good. And then you fly it up to Reno and then you do your testing, you do your qualifying. And if nothing breaks, you race it three races. And then if it doesn't break, you fly it home and then you take it out and take it to the overhaul shop and they take it apart and they go, God, this thing's got 1,000 hours on it.
Strange.
That's what it looks like. That's what it looks like. Yeah.
That's just wild. Well, shift gears back here to the Super Bowl, because I know that's the main event this weekend, and then we'll wrap up. Can you talk to me a little bit about the preparation that's going into doing the flyover?
Well, we briefed on the phone a little bit. Of course, the scenario has been designed already, and we've had some conversations about really, the issue I had at the beginning was, you know, we're in a Class B airspace and we're in a high critical environment here where we can't make any mistakes. And so I'm real, what I'm saying, put a lot of extra effort into making sure we're not famous for the wrong reason.
Right.
And another thing too, single engine warbirds over the water is not good for me. So our original departure out of here for me was to take the flight out 15, 25 miles off the coast all the way around and all the way to Point Dune. And at 3,000 feet, I just, it's not World War II and it's my airplane. And
yeah,
we have to find another way to do it. Unfortunately, it wasn't an issue because I just explained that I can safely and also legally least amount of conflict take the inland route, you know. So I'll launch maybe 10 minutes ahead of the jets out of here, and I'll go over Fullerton Airport, then I'll go over El Monte Airport, then over Van Nuys and or Burbank Van Nuys, and then down to Point Dune and intercept the group when they're in the orbit. And then once we're all joined in the orbit, and then, you know, they'll join on me. And then we haven't briefed the scenario yet, but, you know, if it's what I'm envisioning, you know, we'll go on a specified orbit that we know the time frame at a certain speed, and through communication on the ground, hey, we're 15, 18 miles away from the stadium. So it might be the same issue we had when you and I were doing it.
Yeah.
Then when they give us the time hack, then we'll, extend a downwind or cut a corner or whatever. And we're going to be about 280 knots. That's about all we can work with. We could slow down a little bit if we're a little fast, but we don't have at this time anyway, the ability to like pull a 360 out there or anything once we've started our turn in. So, but it's going to work out.
Yeah, no, well, and you did bring up an interesting point. Nike and I just kind of touched on it. I alluded to the air show I did in Miami. I was flying with Gumby. He was in Bum Steer, but they wanted us to hold over the water. Not a spot you really want to be at, you know, 2,000 feet over the water in a Mustang. I really didn't want to be that spot in an F-16, right? I got the get out of jail free card, but I'm not going to make it back to our runway at that low altitude. So a lot of people who are seeing the flyover, they see the jets and the planes go by, and that's it. But can you tell me just a little bit, like, your thought when it comes to, like, emergency planning when you're, you know, looking at this, hey, we want you to do X, Y, and Z. What are you thinking about as you go out there in a single-engine plane?
Well, through my career, I've had several off-airport landings. Of course, a lot of it is kind of planes that fly, and they kind of fly in a tube. But so I'm really keen on keeping an eye on places that, you know, I've got 12,000+ hours, so it doesn't happen very often, but it, you know, it could happen anytime.
Yeah.
So a single engine over heavily densely populated areas. We're in a hold that is alongside the beach. That's a good spot. And as we turn in, well, our speed is up. So let's say if we just start our approach, we have a problem. Santa Monica Airport's there. And after we make our turn towards the stadium, LAX is there. And after we pass the stadium, Hawthorne Airport is there. And then as we head towards Palos Verdes, there's Torrance. So in my case, when I have a 14-to-1 glide ratio, at 285 knots, I could make 10 miles without a problem. I think the F-16 is probably going to glide about 285 feet, probably at 285 knots, right?
It's more of a brick. And people would always ask you, like, what are you doing on these cross-country flights? What are you thinking about? I'm like, I'm always thinking about my engine quitting. I'm always looking for the nearest piece of concrete because I'm waiting for the motor to cough. I'm waiting for, you know, just something weird to happen. Oil pump blowout. And then it's going to be a bad day because, you do it a lot and it's a very rare occurrence, but you got to be ready because it could happen at any point.
It can happen, yeah. But I think in our case, with our ACC, they've looked at this and they're comfortable. The guys are all comfortable with it. Everybody's going to be, you know, we're going to be aware of it. But we do have a plan that will prevent us from, you know, endangering anybody on the ground.
Yeah, no, it's part of, I would say it's not part of doing business, right? But that's risk mitigation. You're always looking at it, right? And making adjustments, right. Just like you mentioned, going out over the water 15 miles doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So,
right. I mean, if there was a war going on or if there was a reason to do it, I'd say, otherwise, I'm not going
to
do it.
Yeah, there's no point to buy this, you know, this additional risk for no reason whatsoever. So
exactly, right, yeah.
Well, Steve, I really appreciate you taking the time just to kind of talk through a little bit. I'm excited to watch the flyover. I'm slightly jealous because I think you're not going to be as cold as we were in 2018 flying over Minneapolis.
Yeah. I'm not going to wear a jacket this time instead of long underwear and a sweater and a jacket. Yeah, I've never been in that environment in that kind of airplane before. I don't think I've ever been in that environment where I've been in Idaho flying, you know, a beaver or something, but you just got a big jacket and you got a nice teeter. But that was very trying. And that's part of the excitement though. That was a good one.
It made for some memories.
And it's, I got to tell you too, it's always been great watching you fly. And I was always impressed, you know, your attitude and, you know, you've got a lot going for yourself it makes me proud to have been a part of your career too. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Kind words again. I know you have forgotten more about aviation than I'll ever know. And so it's humbling. Well, it was fun to fly with you. It's fun to see you do what you do best. And I'm excited. Again, I wish I could do the Super Bowl flyer wreath again. And I think it'd be a little less cold, like I mentioned. Because again, I've never been that cold in my entire life. And I'm a Georgia boy. I don't do cold.
Yeah. I was in a heated hangar and I was all strapped in and with a jacket on. They opened the door. I had the canopy closed even. Push outside, start it up. Yeah, and the coolant door on a Mustang is air-cooled. It's a radiator like a car. And the coolant door regulates the air. So it was all the way closed to warm up. And it has an indicator in the cockpit so you know where the door runs.
Yeah.
And it never came off of closed the whole time. Even on takeoff and climb out, it was shut tight. So that's how cold it was outside.
Yeah, and the other aspect, Saturday I flew because I had a fam flight and it was snowing in Minneapolis, and I had a de-ice. First time I've ever been de-iced. And we do have a base in Misawa, Japan that gets snow, but usually, like if it's snowing, you're not flying. And I actually was talking to my old boss, who's a weapons school instructor, really sharp guy. And I was like, yeah, how'd I get de-ice? He's like, we can get de-ice in the F-16. I'm like, yeah, we have a checklist for it. You know, I had to bust out the checklist. I talked to some buddies who'd been at Misawa. I'm like, I had to figure this thing out because it was so cold.
Yeah. Whew. That's cool.
But yeah, so looking forward to this weekend. Thanks for everything you do.
You too.
A really great, I mean, obviously an incredible run with Heritage Flight. I know you're still, you got a lot of other things going on, but it's cool to see kind of the culmination of the Heritage Flight, I think, with the Super Bowl weekend, because that's a relatively big event. So looking forward to it.
That's huge. Yeah. But thanks. It's a pleasure seeing you. And I look at this old guy on the screen too. It was like, who the hell?
Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. It can save you time and money, so you provide your family with a financial safety net starting today. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius gives you unbiased advice from a licensed expert. They have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot from customers who have found the best fit for their needs. Policy Genius helps you compare your options from top companies and their teams of licensed experts. Talk to a team of award-winning agents who will walk you through the process step by step. Easily compare quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. Your work life insurance policy might not be enough to protect your family's needs. Finding the right policy can be time-consuming and overwhelming. Let Policy Genius help you find the right policy and protect your family today.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The hell is that? But it happens like that, I'm telling you. I used to be the junior member of all the Warbird groups, really. Now I'm one of the only few survivors anymore, you know, that still do it. But
good problems to have.
Yeah, I guess that's not a problem. Yeah. Hey, thanks, Rain.
Thanks, cool. Steve. Take care. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. We'll just go from there if you're good with it.
Yeah, Bob, you were there.
Yeah, right. Awesome. Well, Nike, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Happy to have you on here, and looking forward to chatting a little bit about the Super Bowl and your experience with it and what you're getting ready to do.
No, I appreciate that, my friend. Thank you for having me on. Another Super Bowl, another time.
Yeah. So with that being said, you say another Super Bowl, another time. Can you tell everyone what it is you do here? What are you teeing up? Because you got a lot of responsibilities on your shoulders this upcoming weekend. Not that you don't have it normally, but this weekend in particular.
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure anybody anywhere knows what I do here, but I kind of fell into the greatest job in the Air Force that I didn't even know existed. So being the chief of aerial events, we're responsible. Our office, the team, is responsible for all the Air Force flyovers in the National Capital Region, which makes us uniquely postured to be the resident experts on flyover timing. No offense to Thunderbirds who may be listening, but we do this a lot for Arlington National Cemetery flyovers, which is very humbling and a great honor. And in the former president with his 4th of July flyovers, and you know, we get a lot of experience. So never in my deepest thoughts when I was sitting in Korea 6 years ago did I think that I would be in a job where I would get to go to the Super Bowl, and here I am at my third one. So I take the responsibility seriously. Oh, you're going to the Super Bowl, you're getting all the fun. And I don't downplay that, but at the same time it's an awful lot of work, you know, with our PA partners and whatever else with the incentive flights we do, and trying to get that recruiting and public affairs type message out to people. You know, it's, as you're aware, it's an awful lot of long days, not necessarily in the best environments, although I'm in Southern California right now, so we're good. And then a lot of pressure to hit home of the brave.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It is a really good deal, but you know, you and I, the 2018 flyover, the Super Bowl, I mean, I remember that. It was so busy leading up to it. One, I mean, you're talking the buildup a month out, and this first time doing Heritage Flight, I think it was 2018 for the Super Bowl, getting waivers to fly lower. There's a lot that's happening coordination-wise before the Jets even get there. I mean, simple stuff, even getting hotel rooms. Turns out that can be a challenge when you're going to a city that's having a Super Bowl. So
weird.
Yeah, strange. So there's a lot that goes into it, let alone when it comes down to flying over. So I'll kind of jump back to my experience 2018. We did a practice on Friday. There's a lot that goes into that aspect. We had some hurdles to overcome. The fact that the stadium has RF blocking glass, and it was negative 15 outside. Simple stuff like being able to communicate is not always a guarantee. And then before I hit record here, we're kind of talking about the national anthem. And apparently people are betting on the national anthem, who's singing it, how long it's going to last, over-unders. But hitting that home with the Brave, you're balancing in a lot of variables and a lot of factors that go into it. So when it comes down to it, what aspect do you think is the toughest part when it comes to planning and putting all this together?
That's kind of a tough question, honestly, because there are so many parts that go into putting it together. You know, obviously, as a demo guy, you were aware that we're looking for that public outreach. And so making sure that we're not just bringing Jets up here to, oh, look, we're flying somewhere else. You know, that is crucial to our job. So working with our partners, making sure that we're flying the right people, inviting the right people out so that we can get that message out to somebody who may not have that influence around them. You know, that's a huge part. Going to cities that aren't necessarily used to flyovers or military traffic in general, or it's very scripted. You know, in Minneapolis, they have the guard unit there, but not a whole lot of military flying going on. Out here, you know, they have the Army Guard here, but SoFi Stadium is 2 miles off the departure end of LAX. And so working with our working with our FAA representatives and trying to get them to a point where we're not being detrimental to that civilian traffic. We're not impacting them. We're being good friends, good neighbors, but still trying to achieve what we're trying to achieve. So obviously there are months worth of planning. You know, the most stressful part is probably the easiest part. And, you know, that's the hour, 30 minutes, 10 minutes leading up to the flyover itself. And I just... Yeah, honestly, this isn't to stroke your ego or anybody else's who may be listening, but military in general, but I call them my demo pilots, but my demo pilots, like, just consummate professionals. And I wouldn't want to be doing this with anybody else. No lack of love. Last year, we had great success with Global Strike, and the bomber pilots really came through. But knowing you guys and working with you guys and knowing the professionals you are, I can't imagine it being more stressful in that last 10 minutes, but at the same time, that's one thing that I don't have to worry about because I know you're going to make it happen.
What? So you mentioned the departure in LAX. I did one flyover in Atlanta pre-demo days over the Georgia Tech Stadium, and it was about 5 miles from the arrival or departure corridor from Hartsfield-Jackson. Obviously, coordinating with Tracon here in Atlanta, they were rather concerned with two jets going 350 knots pointed right at the arrival or departure corridor. Are you working through some of that, or is it a non-factor at LAX? How's that been?
It's definitely not a non-factor. So LAX, I believe, is the third busiest airport in the United States, maybe in the world. And they have arrivals every 30 seconds, whatever, departures every 30 seconds. And so they have an operation going on. And again, trying to be good partners, good friends, we don't want Americans impacted by us trying to do our job, which is trying to put on a show for them, you know? So right. It's kind of a double-edged sword there. But you've got the single engine aircraft, you've got the F-16, the F-35 and the Mustang, and we want to keep people safe as well. So having the ability for them to bail out should, God forbid, they have engine problems or whatever else, actually working with LAX to make sure the runways are clear, because that's one of our emergency landing areas. So we realize that this takes a Herculean effort on everybody's part, not just on the military. And, you know, a whole lot of meetings, a whole lot of hours in meetings, but our FAA partners have been outstanding and working with us for something that is, quite frankly, not something they're concerned about, because they're concerned about the safety and getting the airplanes in and out on time. But they have been phenomenal in working with us to try to make sure that we can get what we want and we have minimal impact to what they're doing.
And it's those type details that most people don't realize. And again, I'll go back to my demo days flying in Miami and actually holding behind the crowd, but with Miami International off my right or left shoulder, depending on what, you know, the turn, but off to the west. You know, that was one, if the engine quit, that's where I'm hopping into. And it was typically an eastbound flow, which means I'm opposite direction. But coordinating and talking about that with, you know, the air boss and then air traffic control who are in the briefing so that everyone gets on the same page is one of those like details that hopefully you never have to use. But if you have to use it, you don't want to be the wrecking ball that just shows up unannounced. It's still going to be a wrecking ball that gets thrown in there. But because I imagine they're not stopping arrivals or departures for this flyover, correct?
Well, so the way we do our teams is normally we have three individuals. This time we actually have four. So the individual in charge of the flyover, he's the one talking on the radio. He's the overall team lead. But then we also have a representative who is with the production company and or down on the field, depending on what we're doing, to work the timing piece. That's what that person is in charge of as far as we're ahead, we're behind, whatever else. And then we actually put a individual in the control facility, and we're all on a telephone call at the same time, so that if things change, the person in the control facility, he's sitting behind the controller. He doesn't talk on the radio, but he can take the airplane speak and put it into FAA speak, as far as making sure that we're all on the same page and we don't launch somebody out right when the formation's coming across. We actually have a fourth individual just because of the busy airspace and because of our desire to make sure that this is perfect, who's going to be in the tower. Right up near the hold point, so that that individual can also relay information should we lose comms or whatever. And, you know, you go into the things you don't think about. Hopefully we see something different this year, but we ran into it last year. Even with the COVID restrictions, we're all trying to be on the same telephone call and the cell towers are overwhelmed, because not only do you have the people in the stadium, but you have the people outside the stadium wanting to enjoy the party and whatever else. And that was a significant impact to us last year, because I could talk to one individual on the cell phone, but the other individual, I had to use one of our land mobile radios. And so in addition to talking the airplanes, I was talking, playing telephone game between those people as we're trying to make sure that the information flows. So it's really, you know, not to belittle it or belittle them, but it's almost a ballet. It's an art as far as balancing where you're putting your time, how you're figuring out what the timing is, talking to the airplanes, talking to your team. And if I didn't have the great team around me, then none of this would be possible.
Obviously it is a team effort to make all this happen. And there's so many moving pieces. Again, it's kind of interesting. You bring up the fact, like, you don't really think about it, but on the practice days, you're not going to have 100,000 people around the stadium or whatever it might be. But when they all show up and it crushes the cell network, now it's how do we communicate, how we do that on the fly? Those type things are always the problems that pop up. And again, this is not combat or anything like that, but you're trying to be over the stadium at the right time. And so with that, talk to me how this all kind of kicks off, because like you mentioned, there's someone down talking to the NFL or the TV person, because the timing is set off their script. But at some point, the ship has sailed. Can you kind of talk to me? Yeah, how does it begin? How are you relaying that? When are you telling the formation to go? And then when is there no more change?
Well, so it really depends on the formation. So when you're talking about an all jet formation like the Thunderbirds do or whatever, they prefer a longer run in because they have a very large window of slow down, speed up. So as those changes are happening, they can be very precise in that. when you're talking about the Heritage flight, you know, you've got the P-51 that has a max speed. And again, I'm not quoting numbers or whatever, but his ability to accelerate, you know, about 300 miles per hour is the best he can do. And when you're talking about, and again, I don't know anybody's slow speed numbers exactly, but when you're talking about trying to fly in formation and whatever, if you get in the low 200s for our modern fighters, except the A-10.
Right. Gator can slow down to like 80 knots, I think, and be fine.
That's right. But it becomes, and dude, you were the pilot, you saw it, but it becomes very uncomfortable as you hit those high angles of attack and whatever else. So we don't have the big window to be able to adjust over a long term. So I've found when you're talking about Heritage flight specifically, the shorter run in is desired, and it funnels in. So for example, last year in Tampa, we had the entire run of show of what was supposed to happen, but we had three bombers that take 3 minutes to do a 360. I mean, we're not talking a short amount of time to turn these guys around. It's similar to a Heritage flight. They're, yeah, you know, a little more maneuverable, but similar. There was a piece of the production that was thrown in that we were not aware of. So from the point where we were told nothing is going to change, it actually changed twice. So they threw in a segment we weren't aware of, which pushed us to the right about 3 minutes. And then what they showed in the stadium vice what they showed on TV was different as they course corrected, trying to get back on time. So President Biden's minute of silence was a minute in the stadium, but it turned into about 5 seconds on TV. So in the last 10 minutes, we went from on time and everything's according to the run of show within a second or two to 3 minutes late, but we didn't know that because they hadn't gone to commercial yet, to 45 seconds earlier than that 3 minutes late. And so like I said, it becomes very nerve-wracking. But to finish answering your question, once the anthem starts, and again, you know, the singer for the anthem is going to do what they're going to do, and we try to stress that if you want to fly over perfect, we need you to do it the same way. But we do a lot of study on what that performer has done on the anthem before, if we can find it on YouTube or whatever else, and we take the practice and we apply that. So I actually look at all the stanzas so that once that run-in has started, and again, you can speak better to this than I can, but the performers don't care what the time over the stadium is. They care about how much time left to go. And you can use what is available in the aircraft to see if you're early or late. And quite frankly, it's not science at that point. It's art. You got to do that pilot stuff, right? Yep. And so you got to slow down a little bit. You got to speed up a little bit because you're a second or two. 10 seconds, got to slow down a lot, speed up a lot. So when you're talking about throughout the anthem, I have done my best to know where those stanzas are, and then I'm just going to feed that information to the pilots. So when they say streaming, and I don't even have it in front of me, but you know, 45 seconds, when they say free, you know, you got 10 seconds left. And so to just give that fine detail information, and then trust your pilots. And fortunately, knock on wood, you know, third time's a charm. So yeah, Hopefully it stays that way. But two for two, I've worked with some of the most amazing air crews out there, and they have taken good care of me. And, you know, I'm not the face of this, but made me look very good.
It's, you know, I think doing flyovers with warbirds is incredibly challenging because you alluded to it. If you got the Thunderbirds or the Blue Angels and all jet, you know, formation or similar aircraft, right? You can slow down together. You can speed up together. You're used or maneuvering together. But when you throw in a Mustang, not to mention this year is a little bit special. I'll let you talk about that here in a minute. But when you throw a lot of different types of aircraft together, everyone handles a little bit differently. And again, you know, to pick on Gator in the A-10, you know, he'll just get left behind, but everyone's working really hard to stay there in formation. And so once you turn in and point, especially with a P-51 out front, I think the ship's kind of sailed. Like, you can make up a few seconds here or there. In a jet aircraft, you can make up a little bit more. You can really slow down and speed back up. But that is one of the most difficult, I think, things to do, is fly on time, over the point, Heritage flight, flyover, hands down. And then you're doing it at the biggest sporting event in the world. So no pressure whatsoever.
Well, you're going to bring it up, so I'll just talk about the elephant in the room. So Indy, right?
Yeah.
So you and Shiv saved me at Indy, despite the little bit of trouble I got into at the FAA. But, you know, I do everything I can ahead of time to try to make sure that we have that timing perfect. And I have had a fairly successful track record, and that's not because of me, that's because of the team, not only the pilots, but my guys in Tracon, my guys on the ground. Indy 500 practice, I don't know if you remember, but it was pouring rain. And that doesn't matter to me. I put on my raincoat and I got soaked, and it is what it is, right? But the color guard didn't show up. The anthem singer didn't show up. And so I think for the color guard, we had one person out there without a rifle pretending to like lock and load a rifle and pull the trigger and whatever. So, okay, that's the timing. I don't think the pastor or the priest was there either who gave the invocation. So we had a whole lot of unknowns, but we had a whole lot of promises. Nope, it takes this long. It takes this long, whatever else. And we had the P-40 out in front. So with the P-51, it's not a jet airplane by any means, but it is the closest warbird besides the F-86 maybe that we have to the same speeds, the same maneuverability and whatever else. The P-40 just didn't have it.
Nope.
And so, you know, that was a big miss. And I still wear that. Like I think about it. It happens. It's aviation, but you don't want it to happen. You guys racing around the track kind of saved the day, and I'll take the ass chewing I got from the FAA.
Well, and for those of you who are listening who don't know, so the Indy 500 flyover 2019, P-40, P-51, me and the F-16, and then Shiv and the A-10. And we're running in, and I think we turned in on time, and then there was an adjustment of like 20 seconds, 25 seconds. And I think my exact words to Shiv were like, well, that's not good. Because I said in our uniform frequency, just me and Shiv, you know, Stuart and Jimmy, I don't think heard that. But Stuart did his best, like did this big Hayaka S-turn. I got the video of it. And I mean, it was all we could do to try and slow down and make up. But it's like once, you know, if you're in 8 miles out from the point and you turn in, again, with a warbird out front, especially a P-40, like when you turn in point, that's it. Like you can do a couple seconds either side of it, but I'll be honest, racing the track, that was the highlight. So I know that I got the FAA kind of spun up, but it was pretty awesome, I think.
Yeah, it worked out.
So, and that's what I was saying is these flyovers, there's so many variables that go into it. You know, it's from, you know, how long is the national anthem singer going to sing? Is the preacher going to go long? Is there something the NFL is going to do? Are they going to give out some scholarship, right? And that goes 12 seconds over. All that stuff ripples all the way down the line, and it has a big impact for the guys who are doing the flyover there. So, and you're the belly button. You're the guy who's making it all happen and making those adjustments. And if you don't get the information, the formation is not going to get the information. It's a challenge. There's a little bit of stress. I'll be honest. The Super Bowl flyover that I did, after the Friday practice, I was like, if we don't hit this, I'm just going to turn out west into the sunset and punch. Like, I'm not going back. There's no way I can face it. So there's a little bit of pressure.
I heard you and Satan talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. There was stress. And for that one, so Steve Hinton, legend, who I'm going to have on the podcast to talk about this as well. He's leading the formation. He's forgotten more about aviation than I've ever known. He's out in the P-51. He doesn't have all the fancy goo and, you know, technology that all the modern fighters have. I think doing a flyover in F-16 is pretty easy. You put the point in, it tells you how fast to fly, you go. He's doing real pilotage and earning his keep. And he can't be wrong. Again, he can't make up that time by plugging an afterburner or slowing way down. But I remember, you know, flying in formation, just holding north of the point, and you're trying to do the best, right? Because it's not perfect when you're perpendicular to the run-in in the F-16 or probably any fighter for that matter. So you're kind of doing like, all right, a 90-degree turn is going to take me, you know, 20 seconds if I'm at 300 knots, not G-ing it up. So you're having to do some addition and some subtraction, which I'm not good at, but doing that, we turned in, and I was like, oh, we're 8 seconds late. There's no way we're going to make it happen. And we made it up, and life was good and grand, and you know, I got to go back home and land and not have to turn out to the west and punch.
Well, I'm pretty sure I've shared this with you, but in case I haven't, again, the environmentals. So as cold as it was in Minneapolis, you know, wanting to have a very clear vision of time, you know, I have a really nice watch, but I got to look at where Mickey's hands are and whatever else. So I actually had my phone sitting in front of me with GPS time displayed so that I could pass you updates. You could punch them into the upfront controller very easily and whatever. And I think about 10 seconds prior to your actual push time, which I was going to echo, you guys were doing the pilot stuff, right? And it was on you, but I had given you updates to that point. And about 10 seconds prior to that, my phone said, nope, too cold. And it just shut down. I had like 80% battery. The phone was fine. It was just so cold that my phone just turned off. And by the time I was like, what just happened? And then I looked down at my wrist. I'm like, what is Mickey's hand really pointing at? And whatever else. I don't think I got on the radio until about 20 seconds after you were supposed to push. So even though I could kind of see you guys up there in the hold because you were so close, like I'm freaking out at this point. Like I told you to push late. The world's coming to an end. And at least you have the option of ejecting. I'm going to have to jump off of off the stadium ledge or something.
Right.
And then you guys nailed it. And that just goes back to the professionalism. You know, we ran into the same thing last year with the Bombers as far as we have a slip. How long? I have no idea. Like they inserted this. I'm going to give you the best data I can when I have it. But until I have data, there ain't much I can do for you. So just do that pilot stuff. And, you know, I talk about the demo teams. I talk about the crews that were hand selected last year, but it really just comes down to being in the military. You know, my time's coming short. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. But the professionalism and the capability of our crews are second to none. And I said it before, I'll say it again. I fell into the greatest job, and it's not just because of the experiences, but the people I've got to deal with. I wouldn't have it any other way. That's why this is my last one.
Yeah. I mean, going out on a high note, I will say you've had a pretty good run. So we'll keep it going, you know. Steve, obviously this is your last big hoorah as you get ready to retire from the Air Force. So congratulations on that. Steve is retiring from Heritage Flight. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of demo pilots that are moving on, or there's a few demo pilots moving on after this season. So it's pretty cool that everyone's kind of culminating in this big event, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm just honored and humbled and happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, before we kind of wrap up, you know, we kind of talked nuts and bolts. I meant to ask, who is the person who is the master of ceremonies at this? Is there some NFL person and person that has the big button that's making it all happen? Mm. There's got to be a producer, I would imagine.
Yeah. So I talked about working with the FAA. We also work closely with the NFL and CBS. So in all of our meetings, we have all these people on the phone. We're all talking to them. So our third team member, we have the person on the radios, the person in air traffic control, and the person in the production booth. So at some events, you can get them to delay the start of the anthem. So like you said, talk about making up time or whatever, like, hey, if you just wait 2 seconds, it's going to be perfect. So just wait. At some events, you can tell the singer to try to hurry or whatever. Super Bowl ain't that. So we have our person in the production booth. Dude's name is Bob, and he's great, but he's pushing the button when he's supposed to, and the button runs, and, you know, cueing people or whatever, or the video segment. So, but we are in close contact with him. We have a team member sitting next to him that theoretically, hopefully, fingers crossed, is on the phone. And we adjust to them. So obviously in aviation speak, I imagine most of your listeners are aviation types, but the general, you know, the random American doesn't understand that you're not just hovering at the hold point and then instantaneously accelerate to 250, 300 knots or whatever. And so I can remember, and I'll get myself in trouble with our NFL partners, but they're amazing people. But Last year, I made the comment in front of one of the producers. I said, well, you know, if we're plus or minus 2 seconds, I mean, that's a shack. That is right on time, brave. No matter who you are singing, it takes a couple of seconds, right? So if it's right before the singer says it or right after, like, we nailed it. And no kidding, completely deadpan. And she was serious because it's her job. And I understand that. But she was like, no, it has to be at this time. And I thought she was kidding. I started to kind of chuckle, and then I realized she wasn't. So I was like, okay, we'll be there at that time. And then when we were by ourselves, just us girls, I said, if we're plus or minus 2 seconds, we're good.
Right. So, don't tell anyone. You want it, you know, it's like, if you can get there while they're, you know, Braves going on, you got Jet Rumble, that's the win, you know?
Absolutely. And we plan to a time. Like, right. The time we are given is the time we plan to, and that would, in an ideal world, it would happen that way every time. But when 2 seconds, when you're talking somebody holding out Brave or about to hit Brave or Brave has just fallen off, you are in that window that the flyover is there to provide the honors for the anthem. I mean, that's really what it is, right? And so I give myself that 4 second window, but at the exact same time, that's a really small window if you think about it.
So. Yeah. Well, I might argue too, like, we can be over the point when we want to be over the point, and there might be more slop in the singing, right? Like, if you go half a second long in this stanza, maybe a little bit short in this stanza. I don't know. I'm not a singer, but again, there's so many variables that go into this. So if you are over the stadium, I think plus or minus 2 seconds, you're going to have the noise that coincides within the national anthem, and that's a win.
Yep. And, you know, good Lord willing, we're going to have that live stream this year. So hopefully people are going to be able to enjoy that just like they did in Minneapolis.
So where can people find the live stream?
I should probably know that.
Yeah, this is the part you got to pitch this. I'll put it in the intro.
I believe the live stream's going to be on the Air Force website. Sorry, not the Air Force website, the Air Force Facebook page.
Okay.
So that live stream is going to be up, and they're going to be able to see the formation. It's going to be pointed out of the back of the Mustang. But when we did it in Minneapolis, I hate selling this because, you know, anything can happen, but we hadn't proven the technology. We didn't know. We were working with a civilian company that works with the NFL, and we just weren't 100% sure it was going to go. So we didn't want to hype it,
right,
and then have it fall through and have everybody say what's going on. I'm still tentative to do that because you never know what could happen. But the plan is to have it up on Facebook, and we've got the professionals on the job, so I'm pretty confident it's going to work. But you're going to be able to see that formation looking out of the back of that beautiful Mustang. And when the flyover happens, you know, you can have your computer or your mobile device sitting right there and be able to watch the tail aspect and prove that it's not just a TV camera trick. Like, no kidding, you're seeing the stadium right after Brave goes away. So
here's one thing too, before we wrap up, but that led me to remember, you know, with the camera, that was something different. We had never live streamed from the Mustang, which was pretty cool, but it required me to fly in a different formation. I had to fly high in the slot, which as a slot pilot, not something you normally do. I mean, you had to bring some real airmanship to the game to be able to see everything that was going on. But this year's formation is a little bit different. What is different about this year's formation, and how is that, you know, is that camera, is that going to work, you think?
Well, you know, that's something too. So I had my PA partners out there with me, and we were actually watching the live stream on the Air Force page or Facebook or whatever it was on. And that's what we were adjusting your formation off of. So I know it was super uncomfortable flying at a slower speed. You're at a higher alpha, so your nose is up. And we're telling you to fly higher because we can't see you. So figure it out. Do that pilot stuff, right? And you nailed it. I mean, you made it look great. What it's coming down to this time is we're going to try to do the same thing for the live stream. But when it comes down to the formation, we want to fly the perfect formation over the stadium. So the live stream, as far as the view, may be better while they're in the hold, you know, in the moments leading up to it. When it comes to the run-in itself, if the camera isn't capable, you know, just for the angle or whatever, then it doesn't matter at that point. We are looking to fly that professional formation over the stadium. So unlike last time, where it was great. We had the Mustang and the two A10s and you back there in the slot as the rock star on TV, right? Just camera center. This time we're actually going to be flying our patch. So I don't know with the video that you can see it there, but it won't necessarily be in this exact same order, but we're going to have the Mustang leading all four of our single ship demo teams. So we're on the F-16, the A-10, the F-22, and the F-35 in formation behind them. And, you know, we have practiced this once, just thinking about the 75th of the Air Force coming up and events coming up. But I think most of the pilots doing this haven't done this before. So, definitely the general public, unless you're a DM, Davis Monthan, the one time we practiced this, haven't seen it. So, you know, we're always looking for something unique. And again, no offense to the Thunderbirds or whatever, but that's why we had the bomber trifecta last year. And that's why we're trying to do the patch this year. And eventually you run out of stuff, but we're just trying to get something different and unique in front of the American public that if you're not near an air show, if you're not near an air base, you might not see. Just, you know, to, and again, it's about recruiting and public outreach, but it's also the entertainment value. And we want to put something out there that is going to make people want to watch the live feed and the Super Bowl.
It's pretty cool. I mean, that's 75 years of air power, you know, from the Mustang all the way to the F-35, you know, from the oldest to the newest, America. Which is, yeah, it's a whole bunch of America, which I think is really, really cool. And something that's, again, you don't see. And I guess the patch, that formation was still, was my last year at Heritage. Is that the last time it was practiced?
To my knowledge, that's the only time it was practiced. Yeah.
I just remember the photo ship, which was Tuna flying the P-51 around, and he had a public affairs photographer. I'll have to share some of the photos. But that guy, he got so violently sick. And after watching Tuna fly, as I'm, you know, going around, I'm like, that looks like the most amazing time if you're flying. It looks like the worst time if you're riding along as a passenger. And turns out it was the worst, probably the worst day of that guy's life. So
he got some yo-yo after yo-yo, but he hung in there, man. He got some good photos, but yeah, I wouldn't want to be him either.
Yeah, he's an incredible public affairs and does some great photos and stuff following Instagram. But yeah, not where you want to be riding in the pit of a P-51 with no control, but it is what it is. Nope. Well, Nike, I really appreciate you taking the time just to kind of share, you know, what's happening with the Super Bowl. You're the man, so I guess everyone can blame you if this goes wrong.
People know who to blame. Yeah, so, exactly. Thanks.
You could be the lightning rod, but no, thanks for taking the time, and I'm looking forward to watching the Super Bowl. I'm really looking forward to watching the flyover.
Brother, it's an honor. Thanks for having me, and just wish you were here, but we'll talk soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.